Right, hello. Welcome to you who are joining us for this special teleclass, the Denver Russell Memorial Teleclass Lecture 2014 on antibacterial efficacy of atmospheric pressure on thermal plasma. I will be your host today. My name is Jean-Yves Maillard, and I've got the great pleasure of introducing this special teleclass lecture. I would like to take the opportunity to have a few words about the career of Denver Russell. And Denver Russell was a pharmaceutical microbiologist who passed away about 10 years ago. He's one of the father of pharmaceutical microbiology, which is the control of microorganisms in different products on using what we call biocides or microbicides. And that is used for disinfection, preservations, and antisepsis. During his 40 years career, Denver Russell published over 450 papers, 16 books, and including some very well-known textbooks, such as Pharmaceutical Microbiology. He gave numerous talks. He was part of numerous committees and associations related to the control of microorganisms with biocides. And still, to 10 years after, is still all his papers, publications, and book are still very topical. So it is very nice for this teleclass to honor the memory of Denver Russell in that fashion. So today, what we have Dr. Brendan Gilmore from Queen University Belfast to give this memorial lectures. He's a reader in pharmaceutical microbiology. A reader is a British grade, university grade, which means he has international reputations. He has published over 50 papers, 10 book chapters on some patents as well. Denoting that his work is extremely applied. He's very successful in getting a funding from various sources and is managing quite a large research groups, looking in part at the control of microorganisms and especially looking at cold plasma applications. And with that, he is part of a new established plasma medicine research groups which really focusing on the development of plasma sources for biofilm eradications. So I'm sure this talk will be of huge interest to you for all those novel applications Brendan will be able to explain to you during his lecture. So I would like to now welcome Brendan to give his lecture to you. Brendan, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much indeed, Johnny, and welcome to this lecture. I'd like to begin the lecture just by thanking Jean-Yves very much for his very kind introduction, and also both to Jean-Yves and Paul for their very kind invitation to present this 2014 A. Denver Russell Memorial Teleclass. Whilst I didn't know Denver personally myself, as an undergraduate pharmacy student, we were all very well aware of his work in pharmaceutical microbiology, especially through what was our core text, Hugo and Russell's Pharmaceutical Microbiology, which of course bears his name. It's therefore a great honor and a pleasure to be invited to give this memorial lecture on an area of research which I hope that Denver would have found of some interest. My talk today is divided into two main parts. The first provides an overview of the area of plasma medicine, and in particular the use of non-thermal, sometimes called cold plasmas, to distinguish them from high-temperature thermal plasmas, which, of course, have been in use in sterilization applications for a number of years, and also for the control of microorganisms. Part one of the talk also examines our recent efforts here at Queen's in Belfast to understand the mechanisms by which this emerging biocidal approach is capable of eradicating bacterial biofilms through the characterization of an in-house designed plasma source, which I will discuss with you in a few minutes. The second part of the talk then looks towards more clinical applications, looking at the efficacy and potential mechanisms by which biofilms either respond to exposure to non-thermal plasmas and the reactive species contained therein, and how also they may tolerate that exposure to plasmas, because there is a variation strain to strain in the response to plasma sterilization. The aim here being then to optimize this approach towards translation to clinical applications. So on the second slide of my talk, I just wanted to introduce some background to the work that, we do. And the work that we do is really centered around bacterial biofilms. Now, the biofilm theory was first proposed in a publication in Scientific American back in 1978 called How Bacteria Stick. The author being Bill Costerton, who in 2012 sadly passed away. He's regarded as the father, or maybe the grandfather, of biofilm microbiology. However, his observations that heralded the field of biofilm microbiology built upon earlier observations, right from the very fledgling understanding of microorganisms by observations of Van Leeuwenhoek in 1684, who observed that bacteria had a differential response to biocides, in this case vinegar, when grown in a biofilm, i.e. the scurf or the plaque from teeth. And then from observations in the aquatic environment by Henrici in 1933 and Zobel in 1943. The work very much began, the biofilm theory really began studying bacteria in natural ecosystems such as alpine streams, where they were first described, but also in engineered systems, water systems and so forth. And also, eventually, the theory became widely accepted in medical microbiology. So moving on then to slide three, just to give some view of the overview of the problem associated with biofilms. Biofilms then represent the predominant mode of growth of microorganisms, both in natural ecosystems, where they were originally described, and also in chronic diseases of humans, animals, invertebrates, and plants. In fact, to underline that, a frequently quoted statistic from an NIH grant release a number of years ago estimated that 80%, around 80% of all human chronic infections, bacterial infections, involve microbial biofilms. Once formed, really the crux of the issue for those of us working in biocidal or biofilm control approaches is that once formed, biofilms immediately, almost immediately, begin to exhibit an elevated tolerance to antimicrobial challenge. We could call this phenotypic resistance. And that phenotypic resistance can be up to 1,000 times, or sometimes more than 1,000 times, that of the planktonic cells of the same bacterial strain. In addition, this biofilm mode of life is focused on preservation of the bacteria at a surface, and thereby they resist normal mechanical clearance and phagocytosis, and normal humoral and immune responses. A really important issue is the area of biofilm mediated indwelling medical device associated infections. And in fact, these infections are estimated to cause about 50% of all hospital acquired infections that we observe in the UK. The current rate for hospital acquired infections is around 9%. So roughly 1 in 10 individuals entering hospital facilities in the UK will develop an infection that was not present or incubating upon their arrival at that facility. That's estimated, the total burden of healthcare-associated infections is estimated to cost the NHS somewhere around £1 billion per annum. The images here to the side simply just show some renderings of biofilms, and the top image is a confocal microscopy, SEM in the middle, and also then the view is of a catheter which has been colonized and infected by Proteus mirabilis, and the biofilm has formed here and has become crystallized, and these concretions are as a result of magnesium and calcium salts precipitating from the urine in response to urease activity. So moving on then to slide four, this cartoon from an American scientific image from Howard Seary's group in the University of Calgary really just shows the cyclical nature of the formation of bacterial biofilms. And in understanding the life cycle of a biofilm, we can begin to understand the mechanisms by which we can modify that process and perhaps have a novel approach to treatment of biofilm-associated infections. So moving from planktonic bacteria, the initial step of initial absorption, followed by irreversible attachment and beginning to divide, the cells begin to divide and produce extracellular matrix, which essentially cements them together and cements them onto the surface. In the next stage, growth and division, the colony begins to increase in size. It continues to excrete these extracellular matrix proteins, nucleotides, DNA, extracellular DNA, polysaccharides such as alginate. Bacteria naturally produce signaling molecules, and when the these signaling molecules are autoinducers, when the population reaches a particular maturity at quorum, then these signaling molecules give rise to population dependent gene regulation activity, which means that the biofilm, rather than behaving as individual cells, actually behaves as a kind of primitive tissue, whereby signaling events take place right across the biofilm. As the mature microcolony forms, then, you see that the biofilm begins to take on these distinctive architectures. These architectures are believed to be important for both ingress of nutrient molecules and excretion of waste. Eventually, then, the biofilm disperses again, and very often this is what we recognize as an exacerbation of a chronic infection. And this bacterial showering of bacteria from the plankton, from the biofilm into the planktonic phase often gives rise to a biofilm formation at distant sites. In slide 5, then, we see, again, from the same publication, from Howard's group, the mechanisms by which bacterial biofilms tolerate the activity of antimicrobial and biocidal agents. One of the real issues here is that we select antimicrobial agents, antibiotics, for example, against planktonic organisms. And bacteria grown in the planktonic state compared to the biofilm state have a very, very different experience of antimicrobial agents. As you know, antibiotics are associated with metabolic activity. But as we see in this cartoon, the heterogeneous population of the biofilm, especially in point one, the oxygen and nutrient gradients towards the center of the biofilm give rise to a hypoxic environment with very low nutrient and therefore slow-growing, slow-metabolizing cells, and therefore less sensitive to antimicrobial agents. The fast-growing cells towards the outside of the biofilm then may have a greater sensitivity to antimicrobial agents, or indeed they may be the cells which actually metabolize and excrete antibiotics more rapidly from the cells. So the heterogeneous population makes it difficult to predict the activity of antibiotic agents and extrapolate data from the planktonic to the biofilm mode of growth. An important aspect here for this talk is the idea at point three that positively charged antimicrobials can bind to negatively charged slime, as it says in the cartoon, or extracellular matrix components. The heterogeneous population also in 4 gives rise to genetic diversity and the appearance of these super-resistant persister cells. These persister cells can remain after the majority of the biofilm has been eradicated. If the persister cells remain, then that is an opportunity for the surface to be repopulated. Moving on to slide 6 then, I really just wanted to underline the fact that we face a particularly threatening situation with regards to the use of modern antibiotics. There are increasingly emerging, as we call them, bad bugs, especially things like the escape pathogens, as shown there on the slide, which resist the activity of most of the antibiotics that we currently have available. In contrast to that, the declining interest of big pharmaceutical companies in pursuing new antimicrobial leads means that the arsenal of antibiotics that we have available to us is slowly but steadily running out, and we're not keeping a pace with the emergence of resistance. And these so-called superbugs are becoming increasingly prevalent in hospital-acquired infections. Therefore, there is an urgent need to find new approaches to either control infection in the first place or manage it when it becomes these biofilm-associated infections. Moving on to slide 7, then, I just wanted to give an overview on plasma. Plasma is regarded as the fourth state of matter, which is similar to the gaseous state, except it's characterized by the molecules and atoms having a certain degree of ionization and a higher energy content. And this is usually achieved by passing the atoms or molecules through an electric field, which allows ionization of those molecules. It's produced on a laboratory scale then by flowing gas simply through an electric field, which drives ionization, excitation, and dissociation of gaseous molecules. In our systems, these produce high densities of reactive oxygen and nitrogen species, as well as charged particles, such as ions and electrons, and radiation for the whole way from visible light, ultraviolet light, to infrared. And finally, an electromagnetic field is also generated. Slide 8. Thermoplasmas have for many years been involved and been used in the sterilization of medical equipment and packaging implants used in the microprocessors environment, etc. And the advantages include a very rapid bactericidal activity, access to narrow or confined recesses, so good antimicrobial coverage. However, the high temperatures preclude their application in vivo and in vitro applications. Recently, in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, atmospheric pressure, low temperature, non-thermal or cold plasmas have been developed. And these plasmas are generated in the laboratory scale, and the effluent that comes from the plasma containing those reactive oxygen and nitrogen species is typically less than 40 degrees Celsius at the point of application. This has opened up an entire area of potential plasma applications in the in vivo scenario, giving rise to the emerging field of plasma medicine. So slide 9 then gives some of the advantages, and this image is of a in-house designed plasma jet. And as you can see, the finger pointing beneath the plasma jet indicates that these are non-thermal and capable of being applied to viable tissues. They typically are low gas flows at about 2 standard liters per minute, so you can barely feel them, barely perceptible on the skin, and there is no sensation of burning or any other discomfort to the patient. They are variable and tunable according to the input gas admixture, so you can effectively, if you understand the reactive species which are responsible for a particular biological process, then it may be possible to tune these by changing the input of gas that goes into that electric field inside the tube. The base gas is usually helium or argon, because helium and argon, in common with the other noble gases, helium has a metastable energy level, so allow it to remain ionized at an electrical discharge, which is at a voltage below its ionization potential. So it ionizes easily and gives rise to these metastables. Also, you can input varying percentages of air, nitrogen, or oxygen, and as we'll see in a moment in the following slide, the reactive oxygen and nitrogen species are as a result not only of the gas that you add into the plasma stream, but also the electron cascade which happens in the surrounding ambient gas. So the reactive species typically that are derived inside the plasma include things like ozone, atomic oxygen, singlet delta oxygen, peroxide, hydroxy radicals. Reactive nitrogen species include nitric oxide, nitrite, nitrate, and peroxynitrite, as well as these neutral or metastable species, such as the helium metastable. Slide 10. Why would we choose to use non-thermal plasmas or atmospheric pressure non-thermal plasmas? Well, it provides a highly reactive environment at ambient temperatures and pressure right at the site of application. One of the attractive features is the tunability of the plasma chemistry. Now, the plasma chemistry is complex, and it varies depending on the substrate that you are exposing the plasma to. But it's possible, therefore, to optimize the plasma chemistry for different applications. As I mentioned previously, if you understand the reactive species important for a particular biological process, then you can tailor those to your process. Low-temperature plasmas have low capital and operational costs, and they're personnel and environmentally friendly. They utilize non-toxic gases such as helium, argon, oxygen and nitrogen, and as soon as we switch off the electric field in the plasma, then the plasma collapses and there is an absence of harmful residues. The reactive species which are generated typically have a very, very low lifetime. So once you turn off the plasma, there are no residues to contend with. In addition to that, you can make multiple conformations, changing your power input, the frequency of power supply, electrode configurations, and even the plasma geometry itself, simply by changing the actual shape and structure of the plasma device. On the next slide really is just an outline of our plasma source, the one that we are using in the laboratory at the moment. It's a non-thermal, i.e. temperature less than 40 degrees at the point of application. In practice, this plasma runs at around 39 degrees Celsius. It's non-equilibrium, which essentially just means that the electrons that are generated in the plasma, and the plasma is actually generated, if you look at the schematic at the side of the slide, the plasma is actually generated between the two, the powered and the grounded electrode. That's where the plasma gets generated. The plasma plume is actually what we refer to as an effluent. The electrons, the high temperature electrons, therefore in non-equilibrium with the remaining gas, are retained largely inside the plasma tube in between the two electrodes. And the cascade of electrons in the gas around them generate these reactive species in the effluent, and it's the effluent that we expose our samples to. In this case, the exposed sample is a biofilm grown on a peg of the Calgary biofilm device. So it's a very, very simple device. It's a quartz tube because it's a dielectric barrier discharge, and the plasma itself is electrically conductive. It's a quartz tube with a 6 millimeter outer lumen diameter, 4 millimeter inner lumen diameter, and it has two 2 millimeter copper electrodes at a separation distance of 25 millimeters. We apply a high voltage pulse power supply operating a variable repetition of 20 kilohertz. Also, some of the experiments we've conducted here in the talk, as you'll see, have been conducted at 40 kilohertz for comparison purposes. The voltage amplitude of 6 kilovolts is applied to the downstream electrode positioned 5 millimeters from the end of the plasma tube. The plasma is operated with a gas mixture of between 99 and 100% helium and between 0 and 1% oxygen at a flow rate of 2 standard liters per minute into ambient air. Next slide. So these are the schematic A and B of the are two photographs of the in-house designed plasma jet. So it's just a simple schematic representation and a photograph of what the plasma jet, the workings of the plasma jet actually look like. So you can see that the most intense plasma is generated inside the tube between the two electrodes, and that the effluent extends in both directions, both up the tube beyond the grounded electrode and out of the tube towards the sample to be irradiated or to be dosed. The sample here is actually a biofilm on a peg of Calgary biofilm device. Next slide. These are some further images of our plasma jet devices in operation in the laboratory, and just to give you an idea of how we actually expose some of the samples that we have been generating and working with in the laboratory. The bottom two slides, to give you a sense of scale, the upper right image simply shows a sample being irradiated inside an Eppendorf tube lid. And again, on the bottom two images shows a plasma device, a handheld plasma device, which has been designed for trialing in the local hospitals here in Northern Ireland. And that's part of the activity that I'll discuss with you today. But if you just note in these images that the plasma appears to be a continuous plume, and the effluent is a continuous plume, or at least it appears to be. That's important to note for later slides. Slide 14 then shows the time-resolved ICCD images of the plasma jet emitted from a cylindrical dielectric barrier discharge jet shown above. Again, you can see the plasma generated between the two electrodes and the effluent extending out of the end of the tube on the left-hand side of this towards the 15, 16, and 17 centimeter rule. To give you some idea of the size. Rather than being a continuous plume as it appears to the naked eye, what you actually see here are what we call plasma bullets. The effluent itself is formed by fast-moving plasma bullets, little packets of plasma, if you like, that travel with velocities of more than 10 kilometers per second. So it does appear continuous to the naked eye, however, it is a series of plasma bullets generated from the end of the tube, and we can see that in the figure beneath. Next slide. The very first experiment that we conducted with this plasma jet against bacteria was against a lawn of, in this case, Pseudomonas, but also Bacillus cereus, Staph aureus, and E. coli. And you can see in the table here, all we simply were wanting to establish in this experiment was, could the zone of kill, the biocidal zone, the generation of biocidal agents by the plasma, did it extend beyond the visible plasma, beyond the visible plasma effluent? So we exposed several bacterial lawns to the plasma for varying periods of time. And as you can see in slide A, or figure A, B, and C, A is 0 seconds, B 120 seconds, and C 240 seconds. These exposure times give rise to a zone of inhibition, in the case of Pseudomonas, up to around 30 millimeters, and in the case of something like Bacillus cereus or Staph aureus, almost 50 millimeters. So the zone of kill produced by this plasma extends well beyond the visible effluent. That's important because the visible effluent gives us a clear guide as to where we are treating the surface, but we can predict the extent of kill in the surrounding environment. Slide 16 then shows our time kill curves against four pathogenic bacteria: E. coli, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, B. cereus, and MRSA. As you can see here in the planktonic state, we see this characteristic shoulder followed by a more rapid rate of kill. But the important thing to note here is that eradication times are rapid, ranging from around 45 seconds right to the maximum for MRSA, which was 120 seconds. So this is represents between 6 and 7 log reductions in 2 minutes as a maximum time point. One of the very important aspects that we must consider here is that the treatment with the plasma has been shown by our group and others to induce in bacteria a viable but non-culturable state. That means that the bacteria remain metabolically active but are unculturable using the standard plate count method. So in order to examine whether or not we were getting complete eradication with this treatment, we paired the plate count method with a metabolic assay, the XTT assay, the tetrazoleum salt being turned over to an orange-coloured salt in the presence of metabolically active cells. And as you can see here, with Pseudomonas aeruginosa in the early time points, there is some indication that the plate count method perhaps overestimates the kill, and that there may in fact be a temporary viable but non-culturable state induced in Pseudomonas. And this is important when we think about the escape pathogens, for example, because we've also noted that this viable but non-culturable state can be observed after much longer exposure times in bacteria like Acinetobacter baumannii. So we've paired these metabolic and plate count methods to give us good correlation to ensure that we're actually seeing eradication. The next slide, slide 18. Slide 18 of my copy, sorry. Slide 18 shows activity against bacterial biofilms. First thing to note here is that in the case of B. cereus and Staph aureus, the kill is extremely rapid, 45 seconds to complete eradication of a 10 to the 6th biofilm. 10 to the 5th biofilm of Staph aureus is eradicated completely at 120 seconds also. However, the gram-negative species here show a very much more extended eradication profile. And this is particularly true of Pseudomonas aeruginosa, when in fact you can treat out as far as 10 minutes before you get eradication. And this is done with 48-hour biofilms going to Calgary biofilm device and the 20 kilohertz atmospheric plasma jet configuration. In the next slide then, slide 19, we show again for the biofilm bacteria the CMXTT paired plate count evaluation of bactericidal activity. And you show here good correlation and good agreement between the two measures of viability. As I mentioned previously, this is really important when we consider bacteria, for example, in the hospital environment, which are known to have good environmental stability. This viable but non-culturable state may fool us into thinking that we've eradicated all viable bacteria, when in actual fact, bacteria that are environmentally stable may recover from this treatment. In the next slide, we've shown the effect of varying our first parameter. As I mentioned, this is a tunable device, so you can change various parameters, which hopefully give you differences in the rate of kill. As mentioned in slide 14, the effect of frequency of the power supply to the electrodes is important, since the frequency determines the rate of delivery of these so-called plasma bullets to the surface to be irradiated. What we observe here is that the increase in frequency from 20 kilohertz to 40 kilohertz is associated with an increase in the rate of kill. In the phase 1, the first part of the curve up to 60 seconds, we notice that the D value, the decimal reduction time, or time to reduce by one log the population, is reduced by about a third. And in the second slower phase, the biphasic kill curve having two phases, the second slower rate of kill, the rate is approximately double when we use 40 kilohertz. Now, that's a very useful parameter to know, that if you increase the rate of delivery of these plasma bullets, then it follows that you have an increased rate of kill at the surface. However, the disadvantage with this approach is that the temperature of application goes from around 39 degrees Celsius at 20 kilohertz to around 55 degrees Celsius at 40 kilohertz. And this has the potential to limit the use of this parameter in some in vitro and in vivo applications. Slide 21 then, in an attempt to explain this biphasic kill curve, which we see again and again in biofilm populations, what we believe to be happening is that as you increase the frequency, clearly you increase the rate of delivery, or the dose, the active dose of plasma that's delivered to the biofilm. But what you also are doing is causing desiccation of the biofilm, and as we are aware, as you desiccate, then the lethal events happen less rapidly in bacteria. The blue arrows here indicate that this initial part of the kill curve may represent cellular death of this sacrificial outer layer of the biofilm. The cells are metabolically active and they are directly exposed to the plasma chemistry. Once this kind of sacrificial layer is destroyed, then those bacteria provide a shielding effect to the bacteria deeper inside the biofilm by simply providing a privileged environment where the material lysed from the cell may interact with the active components of the biofilm. And we see this again in slide 22, 3D rendered confocal scanning laser micrographs of Pseudomonas aeruginosa exposed to the plasma jet. These are 72-hour biofilms exposed to the plasma jet for in A and D 0 seconds, B and E 60 seconds, and 240 seconds in plates C and F. What we see here is really important. In B, and especially in E, we see this retention of a viable layer on the lower side of the biofilm. The upper layers of the biofilm are completely eradicated, as shown by the red live dead staining. And this continues in C and F as we progressively destroy more of the viable bacteria in the biofilm. As this is Pseudomonas, it can take right out to 600 seconds to eradicate fully all viable bacteria in the biofilm. An important thing to note, and it's especially evident in slide F, is that the architecture of the biofilm is retained. And that can be quite important for some of the downstream applications where you may not wish to shed the biofilm from a surface. On slides 23 and 24, which are best, I guess, looked at together, we show the biofilm both before and in 24 after exposure to the plasma. What you can see here is that the plasma causes physical damage to the cells. And we believe that from the data that I'll present to you later, this is largely as a result of membrane perturbation and lysing of the cells. And that supports our theory that some of the upper layers of the biofilm may provide a protective shielding effect to the lower levels of the biofilm and perhaps contribute alongside desiccation to this slower rate of kill that is evident in the biphasic kill curves that we see with these biofilm images. On slide 25 then, we looked also at some bacteria from the aquatic environment that are often associated with the fouling, for example, of optical instruments in aquatic environments, but also ship hulls, for example. We wanted to know, did we see the same rate of kill with non-pathogenic organisms, environmental isolates? So as you can see here, you do see rapid reduction in Vibrio species, Staphylococcus saprophyticus, and Pseudomonas fluorescens, with eradication of the biofilms generally achieved by 120 seconds. However, on slide 26, what is evident is that these biofilms that were formed on either stainless steel stubs or glass slides are much less mechanically rigid than those formed in the flow cell that we used for the Pseudomonas experiments. And as even at very low gas flows, what we see is some disruption, for example in B, especially in slide E and F, we see disruption of the architecture of the biofilm. Yes, we're killing the organisms, but we're also losing the architecture of the biofilm. Essentially, we're removing the biofilm from the surface. And the reason I show this slide is that a number of publications and a number of presentations in this field use very high flow rates, gas flow rates of 10, 20 standard liters per minute, which are bound to have an effect on removing biofilms from the surface. So there's two things to be considered here. Both your experimental setup and how you grow your biofilms are going to be extremely important in predicting the activity, the actual antimicrobial activity of the plasma. Again, you do not want necessarily in some scenarios, such as, you know, for example, in ventilator-associated pneumonia or other certain other types of medical device-associated infection where you do not want to shed a biofilm which is only partially eradicated to, for example, deeper parts of the lung. Okay, moving on then to the cellular targets and mechanism of plasma on slide 28. Really the aim of these slides was to, the aim of this work was to help us to understand why, how plasma was having its effect on bacterial cells. So we systematically took different structures from the bacterial cell and looked at the potential damage in vitro of those structures, of those molecules, at various exposure times. What we see here in slide 28 on the PBS only, or the control slide, is that the lower bright band indicated here is SC, which is supercoiled DNA. This is Pseudomonas aeruginosa plasmid DNA, isolated and purified plasmid DNA. The bright band at the 0 seconds actually indicates the supercoiled or the natural form of the plasmid. When we treat this even for very short periods of time, 10, 20, 30 seconds, what you notice is that a bright band begins to appear above. This is the open circular conformation, and really this is as a result of one strand breakage event, or a nick in the plasmid DNA, which allows relaxation of the supercoiled DNA into an open circular conformation. Immediately below that, and appearing at 10, 20, 30 seconds, immediately below that is what we call the linear fraction. And this is as a result of two double strand breaks. And this event gives rise to a linear form of DNA from an open circular to linear double-stranded DNA. This is regarded as a lethal event inside the cell. And as you can see, right from 10 seconds, you begin to see the appearance of linear DNA, double-stranded DNA, from supercoiled plasmid DNA. By 120 seconds, we have this really just a streak in the gel, which indicates you've got chopping up of your DNA plasmid into various size pieces, and therefore it runs as a kind of a smear on your gel. And you can quantify this using densitometry, etc. In the two figures beneath, what we have done is simply add an antioxidant agent. And the antioxidant agent, as you can see, if you look along the supercoiled DNA band, it is retained right out to 120 seconds in the presence of 10 and 20 millimolar of ascorbic acid, which is our antioxidant here. This begins to give us the first clues of the active species that are responsible or potentially responsible for cellular damage. And also, from a pharmaceutical and a clinical point of view, it tells us that, for example, if you were treating a wound with this approach, you might be able to apply an antioxidant, vitamin E, or ascorbic acid contained in a cream, for example, to the margin of a diabetic ulcer or a wound. Slide 29, then, we've just taken this data from the gel using densitometry and looked at the effect. Now, the both graphs essentially show us the same thing, that in PBS only, the DNA is rapidly degraded from the supercoiled to a mixture of linear and open circular DNA. And we can see the rate constants and half-life for that are significantly affected by the presence of ascorbic acid. 10 millimolar seems to be about the optimal concentration for that. So on slide 30 then, we just have a representation of the effect of oxygen concentration on appearance of each of the various types, disappearance of supercoiled plasma DNA, and the appearance of both open circular, which is the graph above, the appearance of open circular and linear DNA. And as you can see, oxygen has a small but statistically significant effect on long-term exposure to plasma DNA. It gives rise to more rapid appearance of the linear form. Slide 31, then, again, looks at this role of specifically the role of oxygen in the gaseous admixture. So in this case, we would have 99% helium coming through the plasma tube with 1%, anything between 0 and 1% oxygen. So 99 to 100% helium, 0 to 1% oxygen. And what we see here is that as you increase the oxygen content, you increase the rate of the appearance of linear fraction of your DNA, so the linear DNA being associated with lethal events. What's important to notice, however, is that DNA damage occurs even in the absence, and quite significantly occurs in the absence of oxygen. Now, that indicates that it may be due to damage with interaction with, for example, helium metastable agents. Double-strand breakage rate in the second graph on the right-hand side here shows an interesting phenomenon that we see repeated in, for example, viral models. And it says that at 0.75% oxygen, we get optimal appearance of double-strand break. And that means that that's a lethal event, and therefore we can correlate that to lethality in both bacteria and also in viruses. So 0.75% oxygen in helium seems to be about the golden parameter. And we see that here in slide 32, where we see the effect of 0.5 and 1% oxygen. As you can see here, 0.5% oxygen has a significant effect on the rate of kill of both E. coli and MRSA, with 1% given only, in the case of E. coli, an insignificant increase, and in the case of MRSA, some increase in the activity. That may be due to two things. One, there may be more sensitivity to reactive oxygen species in gram-positives, but also it may indicate that at higher oxygen levels, the plasma begins to feel, it begins to self-quench. So you actually get a suboptimal plasma generator if you have too much oxygen present. And we see this again in slide 33, the difference in the rates of kill in the presence of oxygen, right up to 1%. Slide 34, then, we look at the effect on a model protein. In this case, we selected a protein which had an easy readout. In other words, we used a proteolytic enzyme which we could expose to the plasma and then follow the ability of that protein to recover its normal activity in vitro, which is the turnover of a fluorogenic substrate. And what we can see in this slide 34 is that progressive treatment of the protein in PBS gave rise to progressive reduction in the Vmax, or the maximum rate of turnover of its cognate substrate, a fluorogenic substrate, from 0 right through to 240 seconds, eventually with no residual activity observed at 240 seconds. This indicates that protein damage may also be an important effect. Importantly, also, protein damage may be a way in which this plasma has an antivirulence effect through reduction in virulence factors and so forth. And this is shown again here, Vmax with as a function of exposure time in the presence of plasma has a half-life of 21.65 seconds on slide 35. Finally then, we began to look at the lipid membrane as a target for, on slide 36, we began to look at lipid peroxidation and the lipid membrane as a target, as a prime target for the antimicrobial effect of plasma. What we looked at was a T-bars assay. Malondialdehyde, MDA, is a product of the peroxidation of polyunsaturated fatty acids, usually caused by reactive oxygen species. And MDA reacts with two equivalents of thiobarbituric acid to give a fluorescent red derivative that can be easily measured colorimetrically. Interestingly, MDA produced as a result of lipid peroxidation is actually a reactive oxygen species itself and can form covalent adducts with proteins and purine DNA bases. And therefore, it may be a mechanism by which the activity of the plasma translocates the membrane. We see here in slide 37 that this effect, the appearance of MDA on exposure of lipid membrane, is linear with respect to exposure time to the plasma. We also looked to see, potentially the lipid membrane damage, we wanted to know was the patency of that membrane actually compromised on exposure to the non-thermal plasma jet. And what we see here by measuring extracellular ATP or ATP leakage is that extracellular ATP increases after a lag time of 30 seconds, it increases linearly with exposure time. And this lag time actually very well matches the shoulder that we see in the planktonic surviving cell density of E. coli, that shoulder up to 30 seconds, indicating that this slow membrane damage is probably one of the major effects. It's initially slow, but then rapidly giving rise to cell death. So we believe that membrane damage is one of the major mechanisms by which the cell is disrupted and that we see cell death. We can skip slide 39, as it's a summary slide of those individual targets, and move on to slide 40, where we see the effect of the addition of ascorbic acid immediately pre- and post-exposure. These figures show that plasma-mediated killing is an immediate effect, while ascorbic acid addition before the plasma exposure in the E. coli plot provided almost complete protection. Its immediate addition after plasma exposure had no effect almost on prevention of cell killing at all, indicating that the events which take place are immediate and give rise to cellular damage. This is confirmed below in the post-exposure addition of 10 millimolar ascorbic acid in the MRSA study. Next slide, 41, shows the addition of catalase. And catalase, which breaks down hydrogen peroxide, catalase addition offers significant protection to the bacterial cells. And this implies that there is an involvement of hydrogen peroxide in the killing mechanism. So moving on to 42, the next slide that shows that we measured hydrogen peroxide in PBS, plasma-exposed PBS, we measured the hydrogen peroxide concentration. And what we found here was that there was a steady increase in hydrogen peroxide concentration. However, the concentration of hydrogen peroxide was not sufficient when we took this to a model planktonic or bacterial biofilm model. Those concentrations produced after 120 seconds were not sufficient to give us the rate of kill that we observe in our other experiments. And this indicates that there is something more, some other active species involved in the antibacterial activity of the plasma beyond hydrogen peroxide. Whilst hydrogen peroxide may be important for the slow rate of kill, it does not explain the rapid rate of kill that we see in vitro. So we believe that there might be some other hydrogen peroxide-derived active agent in the actual plasma itself.
We suspected that this may be due to the lysing of initial bacterial cells in that first 30 seconds, and we thought, well, perhaps it might be something like a transition metal, which would give rise to a Fenton-type reaction in the environment of the cell, which would give rise to the production of hydroxide radicals. Now, these are difficult to measure directly, so we used iron chloride in slide 43 to look at the effect of a potential transition metal, a potential Fenton-like reaction for the mechanism of kill. And what you can see here in E. coli, that when we add iron to chloride, what we have is a significant, at 1 millimolar, reduction in the rate of kill, with complete eradication observed here in E. coli after 30 seconds and in 45 seconds for MRSA. However, that effect was not seen at what we deemed a more physiologically relevant concentration of 0.1 millimolar iron 2 chloride. And therefore, we don't believe that this is a biologically important activity. But it may give us a way, actually, to increase the activity of the plasma towards biofilm simply by pre-exposing the biofilm to iron chloride or other transition metals. Slide 44, then, shows the effect of the addition of EDTA, which can sequester metal ions like iron. And this, interestingly, provided significant cellular protection compared to control exposure. So whilst we got eradication in the control exposed group of E. coli and MRSA after 60 and 120 seconds respectively, what we see is that addition of 0.1 millimolar EDTA effectively protected the cells from the cytal activity of the plasma. Now, this could support our theory that the plasma generates hydroxide radicals by interaction with transition metals as a result of cell lysis in the early stage of the kill curve. But it also has to be remembered that EDTA itself can behave as an antioxidant agent, especially against highly reactive species. So this requires further experimentation, and we are actively looking to prove the existence of a Fenton-like reaction implicated in bacterial cell death. Finally, then, move into slide 45 and 46. We've moved now towards, so we've tried to understand better the mechanism of action of the plasma, and moving on now into slide 46, we want to look at the clinical aspects of using the non-thermal plasma to treat Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So what we did was we got a range of strains of Pseudomonas aeruginosa from the Belfast City Hospital, which were from various stages of CF infection, cystic fibrosis infection. Now, the reason we selected cystic fibrosis-derived Pseudomonas is that we could get a full range of mucoid, non-mucoid, and persister phenotypes so that we could test whether or not certain features of the cell itself, the phenotypic features or genotypic features of the Pseudomonas aeruginosa, could give us clues as to how we might optimize our approach, our plasma approach to treating these. So on slide 46, what we show really is just diagrammatically the differences between mucoid and non-mucoid strains. Now, the mucoid phenotype produces typically increased amounts of extracellular matrix, things like alginate and extracellular DNA. And these, we believe, sequester some of the reactive oxygen and nitrogen species that are generated in the plasma. So we have shown here that the non-mucoid strains on the bottom of the figure are much more sensitive, statistically significantly more sensitive to the plasma compared to the mucoid Pseudomonas aeruginosa clinical strains. The next slide really shows our attempts to tease out further the activity of the plasma against biofilm knockout mutants. So here we have three mutants provided by Dr. Robert Ryan, University of Dundee, and we have a FLEQ and a PLA mutants. Both of these are defective in polysaccharide production, and both of them, compared to the controls, have lower D values, therefore more sensitive. The polysaccharide knockout increases the sensitivity of the Pseudomonas aeruginosa to the biocidal activity of the plasma. the MUC-A overexpressing strain in the center of the figures actually has a significantly higher, especially in the D2 value, the second log reduction value of the slow rate of kill section of the curve, has a significantly higher D2 value in minutes of 10.53 compared to 5 and 6 minutes respectively with the Pell-A knockouts. The MUC-A positive is actually an overexpressor. It overexpresses the mucoid phenotype. Verifying our previous experiments with the mucoid strains that say if you have a mucoid strain, it is much more likely to resist the activity of your plasma. On slide 48, then, we looked at the efficacy of the plasma against persister cells. Now, we received these persister cells from Jane Burns in the University of Seattle. And these persister cells are phenotypically locked into the persister cell phenotype. These come from very late stage, 96-month cystic fibrosis infections. And what we essentially see here, the reason I show you this slide, is that really there is not a significant difference. Yes, there's some elevated tolerance in AMT-742, but for the other strains, the rate of kill is largely similar to a mucoid strain of Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And that indicates that it's the main kill mechanism of the plasma is probably a physical kill mechanism. To verify that biofilm components had an effect on the biofilm, then what we did progressed to on slide 49, the next slide, was that we looked at the effect of different alginate percentages on the survival of Pseudomonas aeruginosa in planktonic culture. Now, what we wanted to show here was that alginate, which is a very important component of the Pseudomonas aeruginosa biofilm, it's a polysaccharide component of the biofilm, we wanted to show that it had a potential to sequester some of the active agents and thereby protect the biofilm, protect the cells living within the biofilm from plasma exposure. And we can see this most clearly in the black line here at 0% alginate in planktonic culture, shows a standard rate of kill that we previously observed. However, if you look at increasing rates, increasing percentages of alginate, we note that there is an increasing tolerance to plasma-mediated cell killing. On slide 50, then, we looked at the effect of another important extracellular EPS matrix component, extracellular polymeric substance component, and that's extracellular DNA, which makes up a significant proportion, especially in cystic fibrosis infections, makes up a significant proportion of the extracellular polymeric substance of Pseudomonas aeruginosa biofilms. Here the effect we see is less dramatic. However, at 30 seconds exposure time, we do see some significant, especially at 75 micrograms per mil, the highest concentration of DNA used, we do see significant protection to the cells on exposure to the plasma jet. Now, this makes sense in the context of our previous DNA exposure at work, which showed that after about 30 seconds, you began to get significant degradation of DNA. And it might just be that the DNA is degraded to such an extent that it no longer has the capacity at a minute and beyond to sequester the active species of the plasma. In 51, then, slide 51, the next slide, we looked at the combined effect of both DNA and alginate on Pseudomonas aeruginosa survival. And what we see here is that there is a synergistic effect, especially at 50 micrograms of DNA and 0.5% alginate. Now, we selected 0.5% alginate just as a practical, the viscosity of the solution, of the batch culture, increases beyond 1 and 1.5%. So we decided 0.5% was enough to give us an effect which we could see a synergistic effect with DNA, extracellular DNA. This slide indicates then, finally, and the next slide in 52, indicates that the combination shown in both red and blue boxes here on the table show that alginate and the control in the red box shows the standard kill curve, whereas the combination of various concentrations of DNA and exogenous alginate, especially in the blue box, the 50 micrograms per mil DNA and 0.5% alginate, there are significant effects on the ability to protect the cells in this batch culture containing these extracellular components from the effects of the plasma. So this indicates that both extracellular DNA and to a greater extent alginate have a much have a very important role to play in the tolerance of biofilm-associated bacteria to the plasma. In 53, then, one of my last slides, this is from the Daily Telegraph of London, the Irish Republic version of the Daily Telegraph, which said that a number of cases in December and November 2012, was reaching almost 750,000, and this vomiting bug outbreak was closing hundreds of wards across Great Britain and Ireland. We also looked at slide 54, the effect of the plasma against the MS2 bacteriophage. Now, Jean-Yves and others have published the use of MS2 bacteriophage as a surrogate for norovirus, and therefore we used that to have a look and see whether or not our plasma device could also decontaminate surfaces that were exposed to things like norovirus. And what we showed here in this figure was that actually the 0.75% admixture of oxygen in the helium carrier gas gave the maximal effect. And what you can see next to that at 1% was it was a sharp drop-off in activity. And this, we believe, is due to two things: failure of the plasma through self-quenching, and therefore a reduction in the reactive oxygen species. So in summary then, on slide 55, rapid bacterial cell effects with more than one target, with more than one reactive species involved, are a characteristic of non-thermal plasma-mediated bacterial antibacterial activity. Very significant log reductions, up to 4 log reductions of 48-hour Pseudomonas aeruginosa biofilms can be achieved within 4 minutes. Typical kill curves are biphasic in nature, which may indicate that there is a shielding effect from surface layers of the biofilm, or that sequestering of active species by cellular components of a sacrificial outer layer of the biofilm may be a feature. Plasma interaction with liquid has implications for planktonic kill rate, and the rate of propagation of the reactive species into liquid is naturally different. The chemistry is very different when exposing the plasma to a liquid, and therefore we typically see reduced rates of kill in the planktonic phase for that reason, because you're really looking at a very, very different chemistry. What you're looking at there is the transition of reactive oxygen species from a gas to a liquid, and that naturally involves screening of some reactive species out, and in most cases is a predominance of things like hydrogen peroxide, which are the dominant reactive species. So that has implications for the different types of application that we foresee for this particular approach. As I mentioned, there's multiple cellular targets, which may have a beneficial effect in reducing the emergence of resistance to this. The effect of biofilm subpopulations must be considered in long-term infections. And biofilm components, finally, are critical mediators of bacterial biofilm tolerance to non-thermal plasma treatment. Next slide, then, just some future directions for my group. That includes an industrially and governmentally funded proof of concept grant, which is aiming to develop a portable system based on the device described herein for hospital control of biofilms, planktonic bacteria, and also viral pathogens on surfaces. And in late 2014, we will begin ward testing of that device in NHS facilities here in Belfast, alongside safety and biocompatibility testing and phase one safety trials. Ultimately, with the appropriate funding and backing, we will take this forward into trials in animals and eventually patients for the treatment of topical biofilm-associated wounds. It just remains for me, therefore, to acknowledge my group, especially Bill Graham from the Centre for Plasma Physics at Queen's, Sean Gorman from the School of Pharmacy, and Mahmoud Al-Gawarik of the University of Jordan, a former PhD student of mine, and Neda, both PhD students of mine. So I thank all those that have collaborated and contributed to this work. Thank you very much for your attention over the past hour. I appreciate your attention to a speaker that you cannot see. So thank you very much indeed. I've been asked to show the following slides on 59 and 30, just to thank the teleclass patrons, Virox, World Health Organization, and CREM, Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology, and draw your attention on slide 59 to the upcoming events in the webtraining.com schedule. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Brendan, for this scientifically rich teleclass on the use of atmospheric pressure called plasma. It certainly reminds us of the amount of work that needs to be done before we can use a new device in practice. I mean, work to understand or to optimize the activity of a device or to understand how it works. So I find that teleclass a very fascinating. Again, thank you very much, and it is a goodbye from me, and I guess from Brendan. Thank you very much,
thank
and goodbye.
Thank you.